the meeting to order. The Representative Fritz will move the minutes of the last meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Seifert, you ready to roll? I just wanted to show you how big-hearted I am. Anybody that's got the courage to vote against the chairman's bill on a day that he's got a bill up in that committee.
I just mentioned that.
That was, you got to go first, right? Oh, I appreciate the...
I wasn't in my chair, by the way.
Well, Representative Dabney's not here. The chair will move the adoption of magically, Representative Dabney will move the adoption of the division report for Senate File 1477. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
That motion carries. It's my understanding that there will be an author's amendment that, in the meantime, Representative Zellers will move that Senate File 1477 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. There is an author's amendment, and that is the... I'm just looking for the number of the amendment. This is what I get for hearing a bill at the end and moving a fellow out this far. It's the A3 amendment. That's an author's amendment to put it in shape in which the author desires to proceed. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Seifert, your bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Maybe I'll give you a step choice on which bill doesn't get vetoed that comes out of Commerce this year. So we'll all work out in the end. I'm just kidding.
Thank you, Representative Seifert, for coming. That bill will be laid over for possible exclusion from any further bill.
Mr. Chair, in seriousness, the A3 amendment, just so members are aware, we met with the State Fire Marshal last Friday, I believe it was, or no, on Monday morning, as Representative Dabney's request to get worked out any last kinks in the bill that the committee had not done. One provision was to raise the threshold from 25 to 100 for attendance on fire watch. And then the fire marshal felt more comfortable that eventually that they come into compliance on the sprinkler in this particular building, which I'll describe in a few minutes, that we not have a permanent exemption, but at some point they come into compliance, and this is the language that they worked out.
Thank you, Representative Seifert. Do you have anybody that you care to hear from? Otherwise, we'll just look to see if there's any. First off, is there any opposition from anybody or anybody else who desires to testify with respect to the bill? Are there any questions or concerns from members of the committee? If not, Representative Zellers will renew his motion that Senate File 1477 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Seifert.
Sure, thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, I will take responsibility as a co-author of your bill today. I did not properly inform the Minority Leader.
He's got a lot going on.
So,
thanks for coming. Representative David? We asked him. He hasn't reigned, he supports the New Jersey version, but he hasn't weighed in yet on the Minnesota version. Representative Dean is in attendance. Representative Dean has Senate File 1091. And Representative Zellers moved that Senate File 1091 be recommended passed and referred to the General Register. Representative Dean, it's my understanding there's an author's amendment, the S-1091A1. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Zellers then will move that author's amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Dean, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill deals with the Stillwater Bridge. I was asked by the mayor of Stillwater several years ago to introduce a bill with some weight restrictions on the bridge itself. There's been some difficulty with the bridge in the past with trucks that are utilizing the bridge to avoid weigh stations in Hudson primarily. Since the introduction, I first introduced the bill, two trucks have hit the bridge and they have taken the bridge out of service. It's a lift bridge that services Stillwater and the surrounding Northeast Metro area.
They did that because of your bill?
It's amazing, isn't it?
Well, you said, I'm just trying to track your logic here, Representative Dean. Introduced a bill and two trucks hit a bridge.
Well, that heightened interest in the need to pass this bill. They've since studied how many trucks are coming across. They did saturation studies looking at the bridges, at the trucks that were coming across. The majority of the trucks that were stopped in each of the saturation studies had deficiencies, not only enough to be cited, but to be, in fact, taken out of service. What this amendment does is it restricts the bridge not by the weight of the vehicles, but by the length of the vehicles. We've been working with folks from the Truckers Association, with people in Wisconsin, and with the Department of Transportation to try to get a common sense middle ground on this that will allow local service vehicles, but will stop the long over-the-road truckers from using it to sneak across. So we've got what we think is a decent compromise. The department initially was not in favor of the bill. They are now not in favor of their neutral on the bill. I've been trying to work with the Truckers Association and folks on both sides of the river to get to where I think we can provide safety for the bridge into the near future, and also to allow for the deliveries and smaller truck service on both sides of the river. So that, in a nutshell, is the bill. I'd be happy to entertain any questions. A bill passed out of the Senate yesterday, and that's the file that we have before us.
Thank you, Representative Dean. You said you weren't aware that some had become neutral. Are you aware of any opposition left, actual formal opposition to the bill?
We have not had testimony against the bill in either the Senate or the House. Truckers Association had some concerns,
right,
that we've been trying to work with them and through the process, and will continue to do so.
Okay. Is there anyone here that intends to testify in opposition to the bill? Is there anyone else here that would like to testify one way or the other on the bill? Are there questions or concerns from members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Dean, could you explain to us what this would do to the interstate commerce between Wisconsin and Minnesota?
Representative Dean.
Well, that's what we wanted to try to do, was to allow for the, particularly the folks who are working in Stillwater and in Wisconsin on either side, to continue to come back and across. So we've met with Kitty Rhodes, the representative from Wisconsin. She had some concerns about some plants on the Wisconsin side, and we've heard from some folks on the Minnesota side. We feel that by limiting the length of the vehicles, we can allow for those local folks to continue to do commerce and service both sides of the river. But like I say, what we're really looking at doing is trying to get the long 53-foot trailer trucks to Osceola or to Hudson, where they should go and be weighed and inspected as they proceed in their interstate travels.
Mm-hmm. There are other questions or concerns for Representative Dean? I think Representative Ellers hit it on the head in terms of what our concern would be, and I'm sure you heard the same from the truckers and some of the local businesses, is that we're all cognizant of safety issues and want to make sure that things work. We also want to make sure that we can still get products back and forth and have people be able to get to work and deliver deliver product. Any other questions? If not, then Representative Ellers will renew his motion that House file, Senate file 1091, as amended, be recommended, passed, and referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing that, motion carries. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Member.
No, we don't want to hear any more Republican bills. The thing is, we put those Republican bills on too, but you can't hear them all at the outset. Otherwise, they'll keep talking way too long. So we'll do that Zeller's one probably last. He is on the committee too, isn't he?
You can't prevent, Mr. Chairman.
It's my understanding that Representative Fritz's bill is now ready, and I forgot with the Dean bill that there's peace in the River Valley is what I was going to. That would have been good,
Mr.
Representative
Chairman,
Fritz.
I think it actually shows that size does matter.
Representative Dabney will move the division report for Senate file 594. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. He did a fine job on that one. The Representative Fritz will move that Senate file 594 be recommended, passed, and referred to the General Register. Representative Fritz, it's my understanding that you have a modest oral amendment to Senate file 594.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have. And the oral amendment goes as such. Amend Senate File 594, page 2, line 23, delete "an" and insert "the". And after "initial", insert "serious". Page 2, line 25, delete the semicolon, subdivision 4.
Representative Fritz, are we working off the same engrossment? You working out the Zeller's bill?
No, I'm not.
All right, I was just kidding about not hearing his bill until the end, but the I just want to, we've got the first committee engrossment of Senate File 594 in our files. In your...
Mr. Chair, I don't understand things.
Thank you, Representative David. You make me feel better.
That's what it's all about.
So let me just make sure. I'm going to read this back, and you tell me if I got it right, okay? And Representative Davids, you listen to. On line 2.23, mm-hmm. we would delete the word "an", A-N, mm-hmm. and insert the word "the".
Correct.
Also on line 2.23, between the words "initial" and "violation", we would insert the word "serious".
Correct.
And finally, on line 2.25, after the comma, we would delete subdivision 4, period.
Correct. It is the comma.
Well, not the period. Keep the, thank you, Representative. We'll keep the period. Are we all clear on what the author's oral amendment would do? Then all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. I'm sorry, Representative.
Well,
I just want to make sure we're all clear.
Punctuation. I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. And members, the safe patient handling legislation before you is an update on the expansion of the 2007 Safe Patient Handling Act, and this is to reach non-surgical settings that are not covered by the original law. The bill defines clinical settings that move patients as any physician, dental, or other outpatient care facility other than surgical settings where service requires movement of patients. The bill requires every clinical setting to develop a written safe patient handling plan by July 1st, 2010. The plan must minimize manual lifting of patients by direct patient care workers by utilizing safe patient handling equipment by January 1st, 2012. The language that you have before you has been worked out, and I do have a couple of testifiers here for to answer questions if necessary. So this is language that is moving forward for our clinic setting.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Representative David, did you have a question right off the top?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fritz, does your bill require lifts for like a small doctor's office and a small rural doctor's office or a dentist's office?
Representative Fritz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative David, this would require a plan for clinics, the dentist's office and such. We already have them in the hospitals and the nursing homes. So this is an extension of, this is a plan, a written plan that they would have to have in their clinics if they have patients that they have to lift manually.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fritz, so this requires a plan, mm-hmm. but not necessarily a lift.
Not yet. And that...
Camel's nose under the tent, Mr.
If they are lifting, Representative Davis, if this clinic setting has patients that they have to use a lift with or lift manually, then they would, in the plan, have to have that identified and have to have that equipment. And may I just mention the equipment ranges from everything from a $50 sliding, it's like a board to slide people from the wheelchair onto the table, or a Hoyer lift, which can range all the way up to $3,000 to $7,000.
And I believe, isn't this what the commissioner, one of the commissioners was lauding this someplace recently?
Actually, Commissioner Swigum.
That's who it was. Commissioner Swigum was...
Well, Mr. Chair, that makes it quite suspect.
Thank you, Representative Davis. I was hoping you'd say that.
But Mr. Chair and Representative Fritz, can I get a definition of not yet?
Well, the thing is,
Representative Britt,
if you have a if you are a dentist or a have a clinic, and patients in your that you have, none of them require any manual lifting, then you would not have to purchase the equipment. If you do have patients that do need to be lifted manually, you no longer be able to lift them manually. You will have to purchase equipment.
Oh, so Mr. Chair, Fred, so this does require purchase of a lift in a small doctor office in rural Minnesota or a small dental office.
Representative Fred.
No, Representative, it is not a lift, equipment. Everything from a board, sliding board, which is not considered a lift, it's equipment. And that's all the way
to a lift.
To a lift.
Representative Chairman,
Fred, it could require a lift.
Depending upon the patients that you're seeing, the patients that they see in that clinic setting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Anderson was next, and then Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fritz, I'm looking at the enforcement section, and you just amended it to say an initial serious violation. What does serious mean, and does that get into the issue that Representative Davis is talking about of requiring these offices then to purchase these lifts?
And I'm going to ask the department to come to the table to answer that. We just worked this out with them this afternoon, and I think she could best. I'm Chris Tata, Assistant Commissioner at Department of Labor and Industry, and I can answer a couple questions. I can answer first in regards to what the definition is of safe patient handling equipment. That's actually defined in 182.6552, subdivision 4, which includes engineering control, lifting, transferring aids, mechanical assistance devices used by nurses instead of manual lifting. So it allows for, Representative mentioned, it allows for various different options. By changing the enforcement portion to say that initially for a serious violation, there won't be any penalty in order to comply with other sections of the OSHA statutory language, we felt we needed to be able to add that in there because there's other sections in the statute that requires if you have a citation that it requires a certain amount of a penalty assessment. So this would allow for clinic settings to have an opportunity to fix it before an actual penalty is issued.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, does this mean that the department then is determining what's serious and what's not serious? Or
The department already has a standard to be able to determine what is or is not serious. They have various definitions depending on the type of exposure to a specific employee, the potential of being injured within certain criteria. So there's already a firm definition as to what is serious and what is not serious.
Mr. Chair, is it possible for us to get a copy? Could I get a copy of what that is, that definition is? And you don't have to do it right now. I'm just saying.
Yes, we can.
Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anderson is in the same section I was. I'm curious the penalties and then the representative from the department has said about the violation. What I see as a concern is you may not know you're violating this, and all of a sudden now you're a serious violator. And the initial violation, the original language, I think, seems better if you don't know you're making these violations and all of a sudden you're going to get hit. What is the penalties and what's the range that these folks who may or may not know they're violating this section are going to face?
Ms. Todd?
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now the way that the OSHA standard is written is that you can get up to a $7,000 fine for a serious violation for penalty. Why? However, they are reduced depending on the size of the employer, the type of good faith that the employer has done in regard to abating other types of hazards. For a small clinic of this type of a size that we're probably talking about, just with the normal deductions that we allow under our statutes and under our policies, it would normally end up being less than $500 to $1,000 would normally be what it would end up to be. Why we want to be able to define it as serious is that if it's not defined as serious, we're prohibited from being able to issue a failure to abate penalty, which means that that's a penalty that's allowed under the OSHA Act, that if we continue to go back to the same employer and they fail to do what they're required to do, it allows for additional penalties above and beyond what the base is. It also allows for us to repeat penalties, which also allows for if they continue to not adhere to the requirements as to when we issue the citation, as well as willful. So if we don't define it as serious, some of the ability to provide more enforcement authority behind it is precluded.
Representative Zellers, anything further at this point?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, so based on what you're saying, then the onerous is going to be on the clinic to prove they didn't do it. We're giving you a bigger, heavier stick to hit them with, even if they didn't know. And I'm just curious as to the serious. Finish my babbling. It's really happening. You think out loud. I'm just curious as to the need for serious when you already have an under law the ability to enforce these fines. I think for the way the law was written, I think for an initial violation that says if you're not a violator, what under the changes, I think you're going to go to the 7,000. Versus the 500, and that's the concern I have under the penalty section. But if there's a way to explain it differently, it wasn't giving me a lot of comfort language the way we were hearing it before.
Okay.
Mr.
Chair, Representative, the way that the other ones are written with the failure to abate and the repeat and the willful, the only times that those are allowed under the statute is if an employer violates it once, and then the OSHA program comes back and says, okay, you were supposed to fix this, you were told you were supposed to fix it, and the employers didn't do anything to reduce that hazard or fix that hazard. That's the only time that those extra penalties are allowed under the statutory language. So they're very limited in application. However, they're very important from an employee protection standpoint, that if an employer doesn't make those changes, it gives the program more authority to be able to facilitate those changes that are needed to be able to protect the employee. And if it wasn't stated as serious, those additional penalties or those additional enforcement tools would not be available to be able to facilitate compliance.
Thank you, Poppy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I still think we're going to end up on the $7,000 end before the, and no offense to the testifier, this is my basic mistrust of government, and I just don't think that we'll go down to the $500,000 range. We'll stay at the $7,000, and for some of our rural clinics or dentists or whatever, I think they're going to have a serious penalty coming, and I don't know that they know it's know that they've been violated in the first place.
Okay, and Representative Hoppe, if I might interject, just so we're all on the same page, this doesn't yet require the equipment, any equipment, but it does require the plan for the equipment?
Correct.
Let me, Ms. Todd, I want to hear that from the department, though. Is that the case under this, that we'd have to, that the plan has to be in place as a result of this, but not yet the equipment?
Mr. Chair, the way it is written is that unless they are handling individuals or working with patients who require some type of mechanism to be able to be moved, their only requirement is that they have a plan that says that if they do work with individuals like in that situation, that they would have a way to be able to move them. So yes, it does not require them to have equipment to be able to issue this specific penalty.
Is it possible, Ms. Todd, that the plan might be that I just can't handle patients that require the use of equipment to be moved?
Yes, Yes, Mr. Chair, that could be.
Okay. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to propose what I think is a simple oral amendment. On line 1.14 of the bill, remove the word dental and the comma after it or before it.
Representative Fritz, do you understand the proposed oral amendment?
I do, and I would not be in favor of that. The Dental Association does support the legislation, so I don't know that there would be a reason to pass it.
And just so we're clear, if the possibility of the plan could be that I'm just not going to, I as the entrepreneur, as the dentist, I can make the choice
right.
that my plan will be, I can't afford, or I don't want to, or it's not going to be, my plan might be that I just can't do this. And therefore, there wouldn't be a requirement for any equipment to be used.
Well, Mr. Chair, pardon me for being cynical. Thank you. If there's a small town somewhere out in Minnesota where they only have one dentist, and he has one patient that would potentially require this equipment, I think there's at least the potential that that patient could then come to a legislator or the state or an attorney and say, we need to have that equipment in that dental office because, you know, I'm being unfairly targeted, discriminated against, whatever you want to say. I think somebody mentioned the camel's nose under the tent. That was Representative David that mentioned that.
Certainly anything is possible. We have constituents that ask for a variety of different things. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Garrett. A couple things. Does lifting a child into the dentist seat constitute moving a patient?
Representative Anderson, it would depend upon if that child had a disability or wasn't able to get from himself or by into the chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
So Representative Fritz, so if the child is, say, 5 years old or, 3 years old, because they recommend, as soon as they get all their teeth that they go to the dentist, and they're just too little to get up into the chair, and the staff have to lift that child into the chair. Does that constitute lifting the patient?
No.
It does not.
Does that say that here?
That person would not require a lift. The patients that I'm talking about, and I do have a testifier here from the disabilities community. The patients I'm referring to are the patients that I cared for, who was a 37-year-old woman with multiple sclerosis, who did not get examined because they could not get her onto the table. There are tables that are high and low that are part of the list. Was unable to get an examination and died of ovarian cancer. There are many of those folks, and I do have a representative here from the disabled community who could attest to that. As far as children, I believe children are able to get on and in the chairs unless they themselves have had a physical impairment.
Representative Anderson, and then we're going to vote on the amendment.
I'm just trying to think of all the possible situations. And if a staff person felt that if they had to lift the child into a seat, could they then go back and file a complaint with the with Dolly, saying that they have failed to follow their plan? Just under what your current language is that possible?
Maybe we should go to Ms. Todd with that question rather than have a legislator speak to what the department will do.
Well, yes, you're right. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Todd, rapidly, please.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe, final word on the amendment?
Please vote yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. No.
Oh.
Motion does not prevail. To the bill, if there are additional questions or comments, Representative Davids, you can have final word and then we'll vote on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some dentists don't take Medicaid patients because they lose tons of money on them. Here we could have a $7,500 lift. Now, the chair had asked the question about if you just say our plan is we can't handle it, then are we? Then I guess we don't have a fine. But the way it looks to me is you could be stuck for, you might have one patient that you need a lift for, and that costs $7,500. And if you don't have it right away, you get a $7,000 fine. That's $14,500 for a patient that they make $100 a year on. Isn't that putting a lot of pressure on a small town dentist?
Thank you, Representative Davids. And I should have said, Representative Fritz, it's your bill. You have final word with respect to it. So please address that concern, but any final comments relative to the bill, and then we'll take a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Davids. In greater Minnesota, where I am from, I do have some small dentists who have a small practice. However, they do see some Medicaid patients, and some refuse to see them. But these are about disabled patients. These are about folks who are unable to get out of their wheelchair and into the chair. Now, the way that we do that now is, say, for instance, as a nurse, it is my responsibility to lift you out of your wheelchair. And I can. And I have. And nurses are doing this all along. And this is how you are getting into that chair, from that wheelchair. And we have a very, very high cost in workers' compensation and injury. So therefore, we bring this piece of this bill, which has been already enacted in nursing homes and hospitals, to the clinics. The clinics we have Peace in the Valley with them. We are trying not to impose a $7,000 fine on them. That is why we've gone to the department today to work this language out. We are certainly not wanting to impose a $7,000 fine on any of our small dentists. We're trying to abate that by going with this language and with the oral amendment that I had accepted early on.
Cheryl, Renewer's motion that Senate File 594 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Is there any other, any else?
No.
The motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Fritz. And we have Representative Zellers. We had a minor technical issue with regard to Representative Dean's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move reconsideration of Senate File 1091.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. To the
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to on the amendment change the on line 1.16 of the A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to strike the A, insert B in the parentheses.
Thank you. Everybody understand the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. Then Representative Zellers will renew his motion that House File or Senate File 1091, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Zellers. Yes, now we have peace in the River Valley. Representative Dabney, we've got a couple of your bills that you're set to go. Representative Dabney's House File 1685. Did this come through your...
It did, Mr. Chair.
So Representative Dabney will move the division report for House File 1685. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none of that motion prevails, Representative Dabney will move House File 1685, be recommended passed, and refer to the General Register. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1685 as amended in committee applies only to auto dealers and their employees who participate with them in a program where they rent or lease or rent their uniforms, and the cleaning of the uniforms is done by the vendor who provides the uniforms. It's a change in our existing minimum wage statute that limits what an employee may be charged for the purchase of their uniforms. These are not purchases. They're a rental agreement. It is narrowly tailored, capping the total amount that the employee may be done for this to $25 per month. Thank you very much. And most importantly for members, this is a change in our minimum wage statute, which makes a whole bunch of people nervous, but on a bipartisan basis, so that's good. I have assurances from the AFL-CIO that they will not use this as a vehicle and will not support it being used as a vehicle to make any changes in the minimum wage statute. I have the same assurances from the Minnesota Chamber and Hospitality Minnesota that they also will not use this bill as a vehicle for any changes in minimum wage, nor support its use as a vehicle for any changes in that. With me tonight is Ms. Shalander from the Auto Dealer.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Ms. Shalander?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Alyssa Shalander with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Members, this bill just makes a small change to the statute that will just allow our industry to continue the process that we've been engaging in for several years when it comes to renting and laundering uniforms. There's really no controversy.
That's what we like to hear. Is there anyone else who desires to testify or anyone in opposition to the bill? If not, Representative Dabney will renew his motion that House File 1685 is amended. Was it amended in division? Not amended. It was amended in division. So Representative Dabney will renew his motion that House File 1685 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dabney will then move House File 2279 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on Housing, Finance, and Policy and Public Health Finance Division.
Actually, Mr. Chair, in discussion with the Leadership Corner, my understanding is the bill should most properly be referred to the Rules Committee.
Very good. Representative Dabney will then change his motion to send House File 2279 to the Rules Committee. Representative Dabney, it's my understanding there's an A1 amendment and that
correct.
It is an author's amendment.
Yes, it is, sir.
So Representative Dabney will move the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Dabney, your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I first want to acknowledge that this is a work in progress, and I come to before you with that statement. It is an innovative program whose goal is to establish a floor underneath our housing market. It is based on work that Mr. Bugler, who's here with me tonight, did as the president of Agribank in the 1980s during the farm crisis, providing a guarantee to purchasers of homes in five targeted counties around the state that their down payment and principal payments would be guaranteed for 5 years in case of market decline. It's an attempt, I think, both to impact the market and to impact the psychology of people that purchasing a home at this time actually is a positive opportunity for them and establishes a floor for the market that we can all benefit from. With that, Mr. Chair, with me tonight is Mr. Larry Bugler, former president of the Farm Credit Bank of St. Paul, and he can speak to the concept.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Mr. Bugler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We all know what the issue is. The bottom has fallen out of the home market. The mean value of a home in the metropolitan area in the last 2 years has decreased from $236,000 down to roughly $150,000. We have a situation on our hands that home values are in a free fall and thousands of people are losing their homes or who have stopped making payments on their homes because they are in effect buying a dead horse. We were faced with that similar situation at the Farm Credit Bank of St. Paul in 1987. We had over 1 million acres of farmland and inventory that was foreclosed on by the bank, and every time a farm was sold, it went down in value, all that land. We took the land off the market, increased our asking price, but in the sale, we guaranteed that price for 5 years. We were able to sell in 1987 810,000 acres of land in excess of appraised value because we guaranteed that value would hold for 5 years or we would buy the land back at the end of 5 years. Not 1 acre that was sold came back to us during that period of time. What it allowed us to do once we established the floor on farmland values, we started to restructure farm loans that were in foreclosure. We had another 1 million acres coming at us. During that year, we restructured 7,400 loans so that families could stay on the farm. And at the end of 5 years, over 90% of those restructures were successful. Whereas today, lenders are finding that over 60% of their restructures are failing, and a lot of us maintain they're failing because home values are continuing to decline. Once we set the floor, it's our belief that Once a loan is restructured, it has a better chance of success. And for that reason, we have put this concept into a bill, and we have discussed this concept with many, many people in the local community, and there have been articles in the paper about it. We feel that we can repeat what it was that we did in the 80s, and no one to date has been able to tell me that this concept will not work in the housing industry. I think we are asking for the state to guarantee the down payment on homes in a pilot project that would cover Olmsted, Ramsey, Hennepin, St. Louis, and Stearns counties. And we're asking that the state provide a contingent liability of $25 million to back up that guarantee, and feel that that will facilitate the purchase of somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 homes, which should give us a representative sample of whether or not we'd be able to stabilize values. And we would report either the success or the failure of the program to stabilize values on a monthly basis to the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Bigler. Explain, just as a quick piece of trivia, it's my understanding that you actually developed this concept in response to an op-ed written by a former distinguished senator that said we ought to call upon you, and that's U.S. Senator, actually Senator Boschwitz, based on some examples that he had seen you develop with respect to the farm issue.
This recovery plan was written into law in 1987 in Washington for the rest of the farm credit system to follow. And he drew in that op-ed piece all the parallels and suggested that if somebody wanted to solve this problem, they should call me.
Apparently somebody did.
Did he put your home number in there too, cell phone? Mr. Bigler, we got a couple questions for you from Representative Davidson Zellers. Representative Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, Representative Dabney, I guess I basically have a three-part question. Number one, what's the fiscal note? We mentioned $25 million to back it up. I'm not sure where that's coming from. What's the fiscal note? Who pays for failure? There's a failure rate. Who pays for the failure? And why does the state want to own a bunch of houses?
Certainly.
Representative Davis.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Davis. There is not yet a fiscal note. The two points to that. I do have a letter from the MHFA. On this, they've got some technical concerns with implementation and process and critique of the bill. They're currently swag is the technical term, ballparking it at about a $50,000 impact on them for the administration of the program. The liability is an interesting question because, of course, if the program is successful, it costs the state nothing but that $50,000, because the risk is only on the further decline of the residential housing market. If the market stabilizes, whether it's as a result of this program or other interventions or just market forces, the state doesn't own any homes, which would be the ideal outcome.
Mr. Chairman, I'm all for ideal outcomes. I love them. But we have to think about what we're doing here in the state getting in the... This is spooky territory here, because if we're going to become the big bailer outer of people that can't pay their... I don't think we're done with it. I think, you know, you said 223,000 or whatever it was, 150,000. I think we're going down more. And we're putting the state at a tremendous risk here if this bill is passed.
Representative Dabney?
I think Mr. Bigley would like in on this, and I think he's more authoritative on this, some of these questions of Representative Davidson on.
Mr. Bigley, the risk does not appear until at the end of 5 years that house is worth less than what the purchaser paid for. So some people may say that I have too much faith in the future. I do have faith in the future. I think the pendulum has clearly swung too far, and most people would agree with that. But if you study the history of real estate values over the period of the last 50 years, you will find that on dips in home values, and it hasn't occurred very often, there's always a reversion to the mean in a 2 or 3 year time period. It wouldn't take much of a reversion to null and void the guarantee. The guarantee is only if that house is worth less at the end of 5 years than at the time the purchaser bought it. And it can't be through something that that person did with wear and tear. As far as the state ending up in the real estate business, I have heard that a number of times, and in drafting session tomorrow, I think I have an idea on how we could preclude that. And it would simply be that the purchaser of the property has to submit an appraisal with their guarantee application to the state. And at the end of the 5 years, if the purchaser does not think the property is worth what he paid for it, the state gets an appraisal, and the purchaser gets a new appraisal. You add the two together and divide by two, and that is what the purchaser would get. That way, the state would not end up with the property. Then you're not in the real estate business. There are several other options that we intend to discuss with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency tomorrow in a drafting session, and they are concerned exactly your concerns about the state getting into the real estate business. We're going to try to draft a bill that the state doesn't get into that business.
Same thing, Mr. Chairman. David, to the witness, you said that we had reversion every 2 or 3 years, then it begs the question, why do we need this bill if this, we're going to come out of it in 2 or 3 years anyways?
Mr. Fiedler?
What we see happening today is that buyers are staying out of the market thinking that they're going to be able to buy property cheaper later on. And if we swing this pendulum much further, you're going to end up, again, with thousands and thousands of people entering into foreclosure and families losing their homes. When a simple statement to the effect that we believe it has swung too far and we are willing to guarantee your purchase price for the next 5 years.
Mr. Chairman, the witness, who is we believe?
We believe.
Mr. Bigler?
We the people? Well, we the people being this body.
Representative Davids, you want to
take
that one?
Mr. Chairman, I just feel this is a very risky business, and if we're going to be out of this in 2 to 3 years anyways, we certainly don't need this bill. And you added Olmsted County here. I used to represent part of Olmsted County, and there's homes there where the values have just gone right down very, very low, and they're not coming back even when the economy swings back. Just a thought.
Thank you, Representative Davidson. Just the chair's quick perspective on this, I suspect others are in the same mindset that I am. I just met with Mr. Bigler this afternoon. We're hearing this bill, quite frankly, because Representative Zellers and Representative Coles made a good point on the House floor yesterday, which is the bill was recently introduced. They indicated that bills like this come through this committee. I heard that and thought it would be wise to listen to the testimony. I quite frankly haven't made up my mind on whether or not I think this is obviously a wholesale, unique approach that no one has yet explored fully, other than there's apparently some precedent for it relative to a different era another crisis that we face. But I do think it's valuable to continue the discussion. In particular, I want to see what the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and these nice folks can work through. I may not even vote for this thing on the floor if it gets that far, but I might, and I'd sure like to at least explore the possibility. It might be the kind of thing that just is the best thing since sliced bread, but we're not going to know that until we get some of the experts at MHFA and these folks to sit down and talk about what those things might be. And I'd suggest to you, at least for my part, that we progress the bill through here, send it off to rules so that it can remain alive, continue to be explored, and then we all keep an open mind at least to see if it's the kind of thing that does make sense. If it doesn't, we all get one more shot to vote her down. But in the sort of crisis that we're in right now, we should not foreclose any, pardon the term, but we should not close our minds to any ideas that might present a potential solution. With that, Representative Zellers?
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of my questions for you is going to be with or without recommendation, and I don't know if that has to do with the testimony we'll have coming out of here, but for Mr. Bigler, the ag property value versus the residential home property value, I'm having a difficulty understanding I understand the value of land as a whole, but if as a homeowner it goes into foreclosure, we've heard story after story about what they've done, and I know you said something about through no fault of the homeowner, but if one of my relatives decides not to farm land for 4 or 5 years, there may be a few weeds, but other than that, there won't be a whole bunch of real unfixable damage. If I leave a house for 2 or 3 years, it gets broken into, the windows are stolen, whatever, the value of the house can be absolutely worse. And I'm just, you said that there's similarities between the two, and I'm curious about that part of it, because that's
Mr. Bigler.
Okay. In this bill, either in the language or the procedures and application for the guarantee, the buyer has to submit a home inspection report, and if he wants to exercise the guarantee, he has to submit a home inspection report that says that the property is in substantially the same condition as the day he bought it, subject to normal wear and tear. Now, as to your observation that homes are different than farm real estate, I agree. I grew up on a farm and I live in the city, and I understand. In fact, my degree is in agriculture and whatever. But in this instance, homes now in the subdivision, if you talk to a contractor and build a house on the lot, he'll give you a price that'll exceed the value of the house next door that's for sale, identical. I mean, it's first time in my lifetime that homes have sold for less than replacement value. Number two, I'm told by realtors in the Twin Cities that I have talked to, I haven't talked to a whole lot, but I have talked to some, who tell me that you can buy a home in the inner city and rent it out and cash flow it today. And that has never happened in my lifetime. There's more evidence to me that this pendulum has swung way too far and will come back if we establish some confidence in the marketplace that we're willing to guarantee that reversion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll
final comment, and then we'll wrap this up.
The thing that we've heard in Representative Downey with some of your bills is the federal version versus the state version. And how is this different from a cram-down provision that the feds have been talking about, where the federal government goes in and says, here's what your property's worth? I mean, this is a little different angle at coming at it, but in essence, the government decides what your property's worth, and if it's not, then we're going to bail you out or we're going to own the property. And I'm just curious how it's different from cram-down, because it still sounds like the same thing.
Speaker, or...
I'm not familiar with
I don't think it's Chair, exactly called cram down. Representative Cavney?
Well, I think in part this has nothing to do with bankruptcy law. It's a significant,
right,
important difference. This is not establishing what the property is worth. This is giving people assurance that in this pilot project area, if you maintain the property, if in 5 years and you're an enrollee, if the value of the land, of the property is less, you will be made whole. That's very different than the state or the government of any jurisdictional level coming in and saying, we're going to tell you what the property is worth, and we're going to tell the lender how to modify the loan. I think this is very different, and does get around some of the concerns about remedies that lenders have had. And just to make the committee aware, I've had conversations with the Bankers Association. They've forwarded me comments. As I indicated, the MHFA has comments on the bill. The independent community bankers are supportive of the concept of the bill, and I have a letter in my possession indicating that, but also having some questions about, you know, how the mechanics and the implementation that we're certainly willing to look at. As I indicated at the front end, this is a work in progress. It's a challenging concept. It may or not may not be the right thing, but I think it's a conversation worth having.
Thank you, Representative Abney. Thank you, Representative or Mr. Bigler. We'll all stay tuned with that. Representative Abney will renew his motion that House File 2279 is amended to be recommended to pass as part of the committee on rules. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, member.
Thank you. Representative Zellers, will, for folks that are here waiting on the Representative Knuth bill, we're going to do two other quick bills, and then we'll be on to the Scully bill. Representative Zellers has House File 940. He will move House File 940 be recommended passed and referred to the General Register. Representative Zellers, it's my understanding that there is an A4 author's amendment, and that should be in everyone's folders. It is. All in favor of the author's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, Representative Zellers, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in going through the committee process, and Representative Nelson's not on this committee, so I'll trust you, Mr. Chairman, or the Vice Chairman, whoever sits next to on the floor, to give him credit, because one of the sections in the bill on page 1, lines 1.18 through 1.20, had given him some concern. Even though we passed it out of his committee the way it was and then got to the next committee, he had some concerns. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move an oral amendment to remove that section to help the bill become more appealing and passable for the folks in Hennepin County to get it through the process easier.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Does everyone understand the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a representative from Hennepin County here that will go through any of the specific details. The bill, in essence, is to help move the process along a little bit faster in Hennepin County. Also to make the board members, the elected board members, a little bit more responsible for the decisions they're making when it comes to human resources, so that it's not a board of or an unelected board removed from maybe public discussion or public consideration. Again, we can go through the bill if you'd like, Mr. Chairman. We've heard it in many committees before.
Representative Zellers, I have been approached by a couple of folks saying that they support the bill. They're not aware of any, with the changes, they're not aware of any opposition. Maybe we should just ask, is there anybody here that's opposed to the bill? Any members that have questions or concerns or opposition to the bill as amended? Otherwise, Representative Zellers renews his motion that House File 940 as amended be recommended passed and referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Then I've got a couple changes to the Market Assurance Bill. The Chair will move House File 1853 for reconsideration. This is a bill that we had before us last week. We've got a couple of additional amendments to take, and then we'll be done with this one as well.
Chair Atkins, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I think we need to vote on the reconsideration, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Motion to reconsider. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Chair Atkins, thank your bill is back before.
There are just three additional amendments, as you might imagine. The Market Assurance Bill from the Department of Commerce is one that has application to a variety of areas. The arrangement that I have with the department is so long as they are willing to accept various amendments that are acceptable to me as well and to this committee, that I don't have any trouble adding those to the bill. So we've reopened the bill for three additional amendments. If possible, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is just rapidly move the A9, 10, and 11 amendments, and then I'll explain them briefly and see if there's any questions. But
Chair Atkins has moved the A9 amendment. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Amendment adopted to the A10, sir.
A10 amendment.
A10 has been moved. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd move the A11 amendment.
Chair Atkins has moved the A11 amendment. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment adopted. We have your bill as amended before us, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just so there's no surprises to anybody either on the committee or in the audience here today, here's what the amendments briefly do. The A9 amendment deals with the do not call list in Minnesota. There's now a federal do not call list, and I'm told by the department that is working just great. This keeps Minnesota's version around until 2012 in case it's not working just great. But they were actually comfortable doing away with it immediately because it's redundant of what the feds are doing. I suggest that let's keep hold of it for another couple of years just to make sure that the feds continue to do it right. If they don't, then we can undo the sunset. The A10 amendment is the bill we already heard. It was Representative Fritz's bill regarding nonprofit insurance trusts. It wasn't controversial. I don't believe there were any questions, and it does a good thing. And the final one is the Department of Commerce amendment to comply with the federal mandate regarding Medicare. Again, brought by the department. I'm not aware of any opposition to it. With that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions or call upon friends at the department to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. I understand that it's been brought to my attention that we have some questions. Might need a minor adjustment to the A10 amendment. Ms. Wynn, do you have a... Please say your name and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Nguyen with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I apologize for bringing this up so late. We were just informed by our general counsel that the A10 amendment, the bill that was going through the process, Representative Fritz and Senator Shy carried the bill. We have concerns with the stricken language on lines 1.6 and 1.7. Our general counsel has some concerns about striking that and not quite knowing all of the limited instrumentalities incorporated under Chapter 317. So we would ask that the stricken language not be struck, and that would actually bring it in line with the Senate bill. And I'm sorry, our general counsel couldn't be here tonight, so I can't elaborate further.
Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And my position on it, again, with the if the committee accedes to this, would be to look to Representative Fritz. If she's okay with it, and then assuming that removing the stricken language, which means putting it back in, doesn't cause further controversy or heartburn for the department, I'm happy to keep it in the fashion that Ms. Wynn has described. If it does cause heartburn for the department, or if there turns out to be opposition, then my suggestion would be that we either deal with the issue or we remove the language so the bill continues to remain uncontroversial. But I'd ask Representative Fritz to indicate that that's in fact acceptable to her.
And Mr. Chair Atkins, Representative Fritz.
Mr. Chairman, Atkins, that is acceptable to me.
All right, then, Mr. Chair, I would make an oral amendment that the stricken language on lines 1.6 and 1.7 of the A10 amendment be reinstated.
Any questions to that amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment is accepted, adopted. Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chair, unless there's any other questions or concerns, I would renew my motion that House File 1853 is meant to be recommended as referred to the General Register.
Seeing no further questions, Chair Atkins has renewed his motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill is on your way, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Knuth.
All right, next up is Senate File 166. Representative Knuth moves that Senate File 166 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Knuth, it's my understanding there's an A6 amendment that is an author's amendment that puts it in the shape that the author would like to proceed with it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Knuth, your bill. As amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you to several members on the committee for their help with the A6 Amendment, Junior Chair, Representative Davis, and others. Senate File 166 is an attempt to regulate a practice called STOLE, and what STOLE threatens to do is undermine the basic use of life insurance, which is to protect individuals, families, businesses, and charities from the death of someone in which they have an insurable interest. And I think we would all agree that the legitimate life settlement market has a role to play in that as well. Unfortunately, there's been fraud and misuse of life settlement in the form of stranger-originated life insurance, and my bill is trying to get at making sure that these policies are not taken out and then sold into a secondary market as investment. And so we're really trying to protect the basic uses and importance of life insurance as and not have life insurance become an investment product like we've seen other financial instruments become in the last few years. So quick run through the bill. We have a definition section, then we require insurable interest. This is someone who has more of an interest in the person living than they do in dying quickly, so there can be a profit made on the investment, and you can go through that section. Section 4 prohibits STOLE practices, essentially, and then Section 5, which is the substance of the amendment, and so I will refer to the amendment rather than Section 5 in the bill, prohibits prospective purchasers of a policy from buying that policy within 4 years of the policy being issued, and so and unless there are signs of STOLE, and the signs of STOLE are either an agreement or understanding to purchase this policy, an investor, prospective purchaser of the policy to purchase this policy before it was issued, or because that's an obvious sign of STOLE in many cases, and investors and people working in STOLE are getting around that. In some cases, having the other sign of STOLE or the triggers, I guess you would say, are having a life expectancy evaluation done before the policy is issued for purposes of pricing that policy in the secondary market, and having non-recourse financing of the premium. So you're not having to put up anything to have the premiums financed. And so those two together. And so it's saying these kinds of policies cannot be purchased for 4 years if they have these two signs that indicate STOLE. And there's a couple points in here that we're still having some discussion on, including the prospective purchaser of the policy language on line 1.17, as well as on line 1.12. We want the life insurance isn't completely comfortable. The life insurance industry isn't completely comfortable. We need to tweak that language a little bit. And then also the use of the word person on line 2.4 to make sure that you still can have the relationship between it with a broker and an agent, and not have that relationship go away or be killed, but to make sure that we're not having a loophole, because brokers and agents are oftentimes the problem in STOLE policies. They're not. It's not always the purchaser of the policies. They don't get involved.
Are you talking about Representative Davids? I saw he seemed to take offense when you said he's the problem. I think she said you by name. Did you? See, it is an excellent point, though, Representative Knuth, is that we don't want to do anything that would cause a customer, a client, not to be completely forthright with their financial advisor, with their agent, lawyer, estate planner, whomever that person might be. And I know that language remains in the progress, but we want to have some confidence level that is going to be addressed and will be in the final product.
Yes. Mr. Chair, and I am committed to addressing that concern. And the vast majority of agents and brokers are doing great things for their clients. And I would include Representative Davids in that category. But the problem is it's not always the folks, the investors or purchasers of the policies that are doing this on the front end. They need some help in the middle, and we want to make sure that we don't open that up to cause a loophole in this bill. So that's the amendment, and Section 6 is making sure the life settlement market has quick processing of policies and change of ownership by the life insurance industry, and so that section should be helpful in that. Section 7 outlines some fraudulent acts, and Section 8 allows for remedies of beneficiaries or assignees of the insurance policy if the policy is stolen and they can get the death benefit back. So it's not the life insurance getting the death benefit back, it would be the actual people with insurable interest from that stolen policy. So that's the bill overall. I'm going to have a few comments from Robin Rowan, who I think we had a few things handed out to you. You should have a chart like this, which she'll refer to as, unless you want me to think, you can refer to it. And then there's also, you have an ad just so you can see how seniors are brought into the STOLI and these fraud practices. You should have an ad as well that you can check out. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Robin Rowan.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. I want to especially thank Representative Knuth, Representative Davids, and the chair for their help and time and attention to this issue, and all the other committee members as well, because I know everyone has spent a lot of time learning and getting their arms around this issue. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. My members sell life insurance as well as other financial security products in this state. And we are very concerned about STOLI transactions. We believe STOLI turns life insurance, instead of being something, as Representative Knuth said, to protect a family, a business, or charity, it turns it into a vehicle for wagering on human life. And that's not our term. That's a term that was coined by the Supreme Court for any insurance policy that does not have an insurable interest. And STOLI policies put seniors at financial risk. And it requires all Minnesota life insurance policy holders to pay for that in terms of higher premiums. And on your desk, you have an example of what a STOLI pitch looks like. What they do is because investors cannot take out a policy on a senior directly, if you came to an insurance company and handed an application that had Deutsche Bank on the beneficiary line, the insurance company would say, no, that violates insurable interest laws. We cannot issue this policy. So what they have to do instead is create elaborate schemes to make the transaction look legitimate up front, when the sole purpose is to sell it to investors after the end of generally a two-year contested period. So you see the ad, what it does is it asks for encourages seniors to tap into their unused life insurance capacity as an untapped asset, and that is code for buying a policy for purposes of investors. And you'll notice they offer free insurance and no money down, the basic free lunch, and obviously the question is, it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, and it in fact is. Our goal with Representative Knuth on her legislation is to strike the appropriate balance. We want to deter STOLI transactions before they start, but at the same time, we recognize that there is a legitimate secondary market and that the life insurance industry and consumers benefit from a safe and transparent market, and they should be able to sell a legitimate policy for any purpose at any time. We believe the amendment today is a significant step in the right direction. As Representative Knuth indicated, there are more things that need to be done and worked on, and we look forward to working with everyone throughout the process, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. Representative Knuth, is there anybody else? I see Mr. Franzen sitting there. We just love having him there. But he's welcome to talk if he wants to. Mr. Franzen, do you have any testimony at this time, or are you here to answer questions?
Mr. Chairman, Doug Franzen representing the MISI. I would just assist in any questions.
Okay. Representative Knuth, any other testimonies in favor of the bill at this time?
Mr. Chair, we have one other handout we want to draw your attention to show you how the timing of this matters. Having a STOLI policy sold within a relatively short period of time and then the insured dying within a relatively short period of time is essential to it being profitable. And if you look at this chart, your couple years and also in the explanation, the first couple years policies aren't really sold because they're contestable. The insurance company can go in and say they didn't think it was taken out for legitimate insurable interest. You see the sort of two to four years, you have the bulk of the policies. These are what would likely be STOLI policies, what we're trying to get at with that. Once you get over four, five, depending on who you're talking to, you're really looking at a legitimate life settlement market because these policies no longer become profitable for investors. And when we're talking about policies, we're not talking these silly policies. We're not talking 50 or 100, 150,000. We're talking millions or tens of millions of dollars on people in their 70s or 80s. These sorts of things have premiums of hundreds of thousands of dollars a year potentially. So these are not small transactions. There's a lot of things involved, and you need to have that kind of sweet spot for it to be profitable. And we want to make sure that we're getting that covered with this bill.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. Then what I'm going to do is also take, if there's opposition to the bill, I'd be happy to hear that testimony as well, and then we'll see what questions or concerns members of the committee have.
Great. Representative
Muller.
Mr. Chair, my thought was to ask them, I have a question of them, and then maybe they could answer it, and then the opposition could answer it, or do you want to wait?
I think we're going to take all the questions at the end, if that's all right. Ms. Carlson, welcome back. And Mr. Coyle. Mr. Coyle.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle from Larkin Hoffman. I represent a company by the name of Coventry First. I want to start by acknowledging Representative Knuth's willingness to hear some of the concerns that we've raised over the course of the discussion regarding this bill, both as to the Senate side as well as the House side. We appreciate the changes that she's authored here today as part of the amendment. Regrettably, for my client's purposes at least, they don't go far enough. But I wanted to acknowledge her efforts and express our appreciation for that. I want to just note some of the continuing concerns that we have in hopes that they might be addressed as this bill progresses to the floor. First of all, I want to just remind you of the central fact here. The bill is being authored on the basis of stopping fraud, and yet the Commerce Department and the witnesses have consistently testified that there is no evidence of fraud in Minnesota that underlies the issue. So that's just a note. With respect to the amendment itself, I'll just make a couple of comments. At line 1.9, the four-year prohibition that's established is in contrast to the two-year prohibition that's been adopted in about a dozen states that have dealt with this very same issue. And so I believe that the four-year number is a number that was deemed acceptable to the author of the bill, as opposed to something that was necessitated by some clear factual evidence out there that the Commerce Department or somebody else is advocating for. Secondly, with respect to the amendment on line 1.12, we appreciate the change that has been made to the language, but it appears to us that the burden shifting that's going on here puts the consumer at the disadvantage of having to go through this process that the law will now require. Remind you that the insurance industry has all the necessary information to determine whether or not fraud's present. They do the underwriting. It's their questionnaire that goes into the process. And so they're in control of the information that allows them to identify fraud. And yet this language would put that onus on the consumer insured or potentially an investor. So I note that for you. At line 1.17 of the amendment, this is really just a notation about some vague language. The phrasing, or stand ready to purchase, is part of the identifiers as to whether or not there is an agreement in place. And I don't know what or stand ready means. Does it mean that I'm outside the door? I winked at somebody? What does it mean? So I think that there may need to be some clarification, or maybe you strike it. With respect to the use of premium financing as a indicator of fraud, I would just note that in the definition of the bill, the language exempts the life insurance industry from doing premium financing, but it still puts the onus on the life settlement industry to not be able to use premium financing as it's been defined here. And so we think that that's a kind of a disparate impact, if you will, or an unfair distinction. And I would make the same point with respect to the use of premium financing. Premium financing is common in the life insurance industry, including the use of non-recourse financing. So the two indicators that are the central portion of the bill, life expectancy exams and premium financing, are used routinely, I'm told, in the life insurance industry to sell life insurance, and yet these will be indicators of fraud for purposes of detecting stolen. And so, again, I just make that observation for you. And then lastly, with respect to the amendment, line 2.3 and 4, I appreciate the author's comment that the language of used by any person is an area that she's willing to work with us on. We have a concern about that being overbroad. My firm represents a client who have life insurance issues of one sort or another, and we want to make sure that clients can seek out professional guidance from their CPA, from their insurance advisor, from their financial planner, yes, even their lawyer if they need to from time to time, and we have a concern about that. Those are my primary comments, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to take questions if there are any, but I appreciate the opportunity to testify. And again, I want to thank the author of the bill for her willingness to listen to some of the concerns we've raised. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I represent a company called Tamar Fink, and we represent consumers who are involved in these settlement issues. And our interest is to make sure that the consumer's right to sell their private property is not severely impacted by a bill to the point where there is either no market to sell their property or the restrictions are such that they simply are frustrated in doing with their property as they choose. And Mr. Chair, I get in front of your committee a fair amount of times, and I've never seen the insurance industry have the committee room covered quite so well. And in fact, I was talking with the chiropractors earlier, and I spent so much time with you and other insurance people, they were wondering if we were negotiating a 4-year ban on chiropractic services, and we said no. That's not the case. But as to the amendment, we do have some concerns. One is just on the drafting, Mr. Chairman. In the first sentence of the amendment, just as to cleanup, I think you'll note that there are six commas in the first line 1.8. There are 16 commas in the first paragraph, and I think we need either some paragraphs or some drafting out there so that we can be clear on what is being stated in that first paragraph, and we're happy to work
on
that.
We pay Mr. Pender by the comma.
Wow.
You should see what he gets for a semicolon.
That has to be a legislative record, Mr. Chair. Six commas in a sentence. I know that would never get past Senator Higgins. We do have concerns about whether or not there is an agreement in on lines 1.17, whether or not there's an actual agreement in on the front end to sell a policy, or whether or not you're just we don't know what stand ready to purchase really means. As to premium financing, we'd like to note to the committee that several insurance carriers do premium financing, and we wouldn't want to, I don't think, have legislation that actually precludes a legitimate sale of a life settlement when ING or AIG has actually approved in their policy the premium financing. I'd also add, Mr. Chairman, that everything that we've read about life expectancies are an absolute legitimate and needed tool for seniors in their estate planning. That's everything that we've read about it. But we don't believe that the restriction on 2.4 should be so severe that if you share that with your own financial planner, your attorney, your CPA, that somehow is indicia of fraud and that would preclude you from selling your legitimate property. We're happy, Mr. Chairman, to continue to work on this. And I would add on the bill, Mr. Chairman, one item as an item of cleanup from the first committee engrossment on page 7. I believe when the amendments were being added and deleted in Representative Mullery's committee, there was one section that remained about a rebuttable presumption, line 7.4 and 7.5, and I think that was missed in the drafting. Representative Knuth added an amendment, and there was a subsequent amendment that took some other things out. I don't think they deleted that whole section. We stand corrected, Mr. Chairman. That is corrected by leaving that whole section. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Might I suggest if we can get maybe one from the one side, one from the other side, and keep a second person still handy. But whoever wants to come down, and I know Representative Mullery had a question, there may be others, and that's not to give, you know, whoever is the person not at the microphone, you're not being excluded, but Just Representative Mullery had a question, and I know Representative Davids had a question or an issue as well. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess this is to both of you, and maybe Ms. Rohn probably first, since you must have had something to do with drafting this amendment. I'm looking at it, and offhand, I have to look again at it because after the other side commented on it, and I have to figure out what I think of their comments. But offhand, it looks to me like the second of the two circumstances, 119 through 2.5, I don't have a problem with. It's the first one, 115 through 118. I can't figure out whether this keeps out any legitimate types of things or not, and I asked Mr. Pender, and he couldn't figure it out. So, well, this is pretty difficult language to figure out exactly.
Well, let's explain it. So
I haven't sorted it out exactly, but sometimes business buyout agreements aren't the exact typical form that you usually use, and there's some strange ones, but they're legitimate. And so I'm just trying to figure out what are the parameters of this? How is it limited? Is there no circumstance where a person could legitimately have a policy and another person guarantees it as part of a business type of arrangement or something? Not the typical buyout forms, the AB ones, but I'm just wondering if this...
Well, I was going to have the court reporter read it back.
The question's probably as confused as the drafting of this language, I think. I'm not sure, but...
Well, let's just go to Ms. Rohn and lines 1.15 to 1.18. Can you put that in layperson terms for us, what it means?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, that paragraph is intended to target agreements to sell a policy before it's even issued, which is absolutely unquestionably solely. It is not intended to target any sort of legitimate buy-sell agreement or any other kind of legitimate policy. It is only targeted to when people actually make an agreement to sell a policy before it's issued, which is the clearest indicator of solely that there is.
Thank you, Ms. Rohn. Mr. Coyle, you want to add anything to that?
Absolutely.
I thought you might want to talk into the microphone, though.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my interpretation of his language is this is an attempt by the advocates of the bill to get around the recent Paulson decision, which obligated the life insurance industry to demonstrate that there was an agreement as the basis for trying to prove fraud. And so they've drafted this language broadly, which is probably some of the confusion, where now an understanding, whatever that means, is effectively going to be deemed to be an agreement, and standing ready to purchase is now going to be construed to be evidence of an agreement. I think those are vague provisions, but on balance, it's killing me to say this, I understand that that's what the authors are trying to ban, and in general, we agree that where there is an advance agreement to buy a policy before it issues, it should be banned, and that's what we've been endorsing all the way through this process. Having said that, I think the language may be a scooch broad, and if we can work with the author on it, I'd be happy to do so. I think it would be fairly simple to fix, but the insurance industry may not like that.
Now he's going to ask you for a definition of scooch. And, right. Yeah, scooch. Representative Mullery, is that as far as
it doesn't answer the question?
No. Well, when did that ever slow us down? Representative David, who's up next? Representative David.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. Just more of a comment. Mr. Coyle said the way the language was before the amendment that the 2-year period, which for the committee really means nothing, because I can't imagine an investor buying a policy less than 2 years old, because you have your contestability period where if there's a suicide, fraud, or those types of things, the life insurance company's not going to pay the benefit anyways. So 2 years really means nothing. I think the amendment puts it where it should be. I guess that's a comment.
Okay. Mr. Coyle, he commented on your comment. You get a chance to rebut.
I can't resist. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I only note it because the insurance industry has endorsed all of these other bills where the two-year language has passed. And so, but for that fact, I don't understand the comment that Representative Davis is making.
Thank you, and you've now made a comment relative to a comment made by the industry. So, Ms. Rowan, you want to rebut the... Are there other questions from members of the... of the committee? Otherwise, Representative Knuth, it's your bill. You get the final word on it, and we'll vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think the bill is in good shape to address silly practices and to leave the to make sure the legitimate life settlement market remains viable in this state. I think that's an important part of the industry. And just to note, we do have a commissioner, Commerce Commissioner here, and he doesn't need to testify, but he, in talking with them, this sounds like they have the tools to prevent fraud before it gets there, which is frankly a rare thing in our policy making. We often are following up 6 or 12 months behind, and so very happy we can help them prevent fraud in Minnesota, and I would ask for member support.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. Representative Knuth will renew our motion in House File. Senate File, I'm sorry. Senate File 166 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Knuth, and thank you to those who testified. With that, folks, that is our final meeting before the second deadline, which is obviously tonight. I wish you all a terrific break. We do intend to have one or two hearings after the break, but we will give you plenty of notice relative to those. And with that, just have a safe and happy break. Take care. We're adjourned.